Foolish Baseball is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. No, that's not it. Foolish Baseball is one of the best damn YouTube channels that's ever existed, sports or otherwise, and as you may be wondering, yeah, this is an unexpected crossover. We have Bailey from Foolish Baseball, Baseball Bits, and Foolish Bailey, a creator of some of the most entertaining, in-depth, and absolutely wonderful baseball breakdowns that have ever been seen. But we're here to talk about music, which gives this whole thing a different sort of presentation. We sat down with Bailey to talk about the modern era of YouTube creation, and also some really wonderful music here on the 2010s.
Thanks for taking the time.
By the way, I have a list of 10 albums from the 2010s that
yes,
I really enjoy. So
that would be, let's just start there, because that's how my project started, was re-looking at that decade and trying not to do, no offense to Pitchfork, but doing the thing where you're like, how do I feel about this album in 2019? Instead, you're like taking more of a long view.
Right.
So please, yeah, I want to hear what are the musical tastes of Baseball Bits and Foolish Bailey?
So I would call it a quasi top 10 list. I removed a couple favorites from the 2010s just because they're like really kind of ubiquitous at this point, and I wanted to focus on a few others. But I'm going to start with Radio Department, Clinging to a Scheme from 2010. Yes. I really do like Radio Department, but even though I'm not sure if this is their most popular album necessarily, I do think it's their best. I think that just, it kicks off with that first single, Heaven's on Fire, and just keeps getting better and better from there. It's a phenomenal album.
That is a record. That's a band I need to listen to more of. We'll talk about weird music analytics later, but I'm a big Rate Your Music guy.
Oh yeah, me too. We can definitely talk about that.
Okay, but they're one of those groups where you see the reviews of them and they're like, oh, this is cool. And then one person will be like, this literally changed my life. You don't understand.
Right, yeah.
And I trust bands like that. So
yeah, and they also, just in general with like the people I know, like in real life, who are super into music, this is a band they think very highly of generally.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that is from 2010. So we're starting from the beginning of the decade. That's nice.
Yeah.
So,
I'm not sure if we're going chronologically here. I'll move my way up the list.
Work through your heart. That's all that matters.
All right. So next up, this is actually definitely a Rate Your Music favorite, and I would not have found this album if not for rateyourmusic.com. This is going to be Bruno Parnatus. This is the longest album title I'm going to read by far. Those who throw objects at the crocodiles will be asked to retrieve them. Sort of like a poppy jazz album. I compare it a lot to like Stereo Lab or even Sweet Trip or something like that, just with a jazz bent to it. It's music that takes you to, you know, another planet. It really is. And it's an album I only discovered maybe a year or two ago, so I didn't discover this album in the 2010s, but that's, you know, that's kind of the goal of the project, right? We're going back and looking back at the decade, knowing what we know now, and so I think this is a good example of that.
That is a secret of Rate Your Music. Look for the Brazilian music. For some reason,
that's true.
For some reason, the curation through there of Brazilian music, this has happened to me recently too, just like more 70s and 80s Brazilian music. I've been using Rate Your Music to kind of go way, way back. And the scene right now seems to be incredible as well. But for some reason, I don't know if it's that. There's kind of a meme online of Argentines and Brazilians always saying, come to Brazil, come to Argentina.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, all these bands. And I think it's because the local music scene's great as well, and they want that cross collaboration. That is a fantastic psychedelic pop album. Yeah, it's so good.
It's funny that you bring that up, because, you know, we're on this show because I spoke to Braves pitcher Spencer Strider about the Strokes. And I think the Strokes are like a great example of a band who are like very popular in North America, and then in like South America, they're just gods, you know?
So I lived in Argentina, and it seemed like everything was about 15 years behind. They were really into Oasis still, like really into Oasis. But then the Strokes were like, oh yeah, that's like the greatest thing America's ever made in the history of anything. And I'm like, man, I like the, is this it too, man? But like, it seems a little over the top.
It's awesome. I really appreciate just how much they love the Strokes. Okay, next up, Parquet Courts, Wide Awake 2018. This is a band I don't really love their discography that much apart from this album, but I absolutely love this album. I think the song Total Football was written specifically for people like me. You have the sports nerd, and then you have like all the like working class, like socialist rhetoric, like all coming together. I think it's a phenomenal album.
I know you this is an interesting question because you work in a YouTube space that is, and I mean this in the most positive way possible because I'm doing it too, a nerd commenting on jock things.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what the song Total Football is, and a lot of what's happening with Parquet Courts, even the finale of Fuck Tom Brady, which is just like, because he is the antithesis of the, you know, we work together as a team. He's the, you know, he's the white, like, Christian male who, like, he's going to put the team on his back and he's going to win it for himself and get all the glory. Like, it's so good.
So if you were ever to stop using video game music as some of the backgrounds for baseball bits, Total Football is the, like, secret theme for baseball bits.
Oh, yeah. I think you could definitely make that argument.
No, I got in. So I'm from Texas. So I got into Parquet Courts because they're from Denton. And I was a huge fan of Light Up Gold. That I don't love that record front to back, but Total Football is so brilliant for the exact ways you point out of, like, what was that whole thing going around the internet a couple of years ago? It's like, would you rather fight a buff nerd or a jock that listens to jazz? It's
right.
It's like one of those things. And like Parquet Courts is so good at making those really sardonic but also surreal little moments. Yeah, Total Football's so good.
All right, my sixth album. No, sorry. Well, I mean, if we're moving upwards, this is gonna be number six on my quasi top 10. Clarence Clarity, No Now, 2015.
Weirdo pop at its finest.
Absolutely. He's just an amazing pop writer, a pop hook writer, and he's gonna layer it in a bunch of like glitchiness and distortion, but at his core he's just a master of pop music. So this album's great. He's become a lot more famous because of his collaborations with artists like Rina, which I think are wonderful. But this is my pick to sort of represent the Clarence Clarity side of things. His I believe debut album, No Now.
What do you think generally of the 2010s? Felt like to me the era of like deconstructed club and art pop really going for the most fucked up, grotesque, but still captivating versions of pop possible. I'm talking about Sophie, Clarence Clarity, Charlie XCX when she started working with PC Music. Why do you got a feeling on that of why we started to look at pop and be like, I wonder if I can make that as disgusting and weird as possible?
I don't know. I feel like maybe we just feel like we're living in like the, you know, the end of history. And so all we can do is just kind of go back and look at like what was popular 10, 20 years ago and then just royally screw it up, you know?
I think that's a wonderfully succinct way of putting it. I think that's right, honestly. Okay, so Clarence. Yeah, fucked up pop music.
Yeah. Okay, five, we're going to go MGMT, Little Dark Age. This is a great band. Like, congratulations, also a phenomenal album from them. But this one to me, just like front to back, is just like banger after banger after banger. I can't believe that the title track has become co-opted in some sort of like new age right wing like fascism online for some reason, because if you read the lyrics, it doesn't read that way to me at all. And I think MGMT very clearly have like a lefty bent to them, or anti-establishment bin at the very least. But yeah, this is a great album. Tile track's great. I love One Thing Left to Try. I think that's probably my favorite track on this album. It kind of, like, the vocals, it sounds like a crazy like Michael Jackson record or something like that. Like, wonderful, wonderful album. And one thing I like about this album, it doesn't overstay its welcome. I think when an album is like really bloated or it has tracks that I would like skip on it, I probably penalize that more than the average person would, because I want to listen to it, you know, like the way the artist intended. I'm not going to skip tracks, you know? And so when you have an album that's just, you know, a good solid, you know, 40 minutes, you lay it all on the line, that to me stands out. So MGMT, Little Dark Age.
Were you one of those people that when you first heard Congratulations, you were disappointed it wasn't Kids and Time to Pretend, or were you with that immediately?
No, I was actually with it immediately, and I really enjoyed, like, you know, the big singles off Oracular Spectacular as well, that sort of put them on the map. That was you know, those songs were becoming big, like Kids and Time to Pretend, when I was basically entering high school. So that's some of the first music I remember, like, knowing when I started paying attention to music. So it has that sort of like, you know, nostalgia element to it. But I also just feel like, you know, Congratulations and Little Dark Age are, you know, better back to back than anything on, like, than the experience of listening to Oracular Spectacular all the way through.
Okay, interesting, because I knew that was a big divide when it, well, I say divide because Siberian Divide was the song that finally got me into Congratulations, because I was one of those people who's like, where's the jams? Where's Electric Feel? You know,
right.
And it was like, no, I was wrong, but it took me years, you know?
All right, we're going to go for fourth here. We're going to go Candy Claws, Ceres, and Calypso in the Deep Time. I don't think I actually discovered this record because of Rate Your Music. It's gotten really, really popular on there, which just brings me joy every time I go and look at the Candy Claws discography. The release from them that deserves more credit and more ratings on that side is definitely the Two Airships, Exploder Falls, like, instrumental EP. It's incredible, but I'm going Ceres and Calypso in the Deep Time. It's again a little bit like Clarence Clarity. It's a really good pop album, but just with, you know, a lot of like kind of shoegazy elements to it, and also like tropical sounding instrumentation. And you know, I know this is a podcast, bad podcasting form. This is an all time great album, art in my mind as well.
Oh, you're good. It is, you say that, and that's interesting to me because I remember, you know, 4chan Moo, and then Reddit r/indieheads and Rate Your Music obviously have a lot of overlap, but all of them have very distinct, here are the albums that have popped out of here and nowhere else, and Candy Claws, right, and Sweet Trip, I'd say, were like the two big ones for Rate Your Music that I can remember off the top of my head. And it's interesting to see the different ecologies and biomes of these online platforms kind of grow and glom on to very specific records.
Yeah, there are definitely just certain websites that you associate with certain albums. And that's just kind of, you know, part of being a, you know, a music nerd online.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a Rate Your Music pick, but you didn't get it from Rate Your Music. So
no, I can't remember where I came across it. There's even like, you know, I'm a YouTuber. There's even albums that are considered like YouTube core, because for whatever reason they get entered into like the YouTube like recommendation system. So like the song like Plastic Love, for example, is like great example. that's YouTube at work. That's not even necessarily like a Rate Your Music thing or a 4chan thing or a Reddit thing. So that even on YouTube we have our own sort of albums that people are listening to.
YouTube core would surely one of the like Deep Cuts or someone like this has done this, but you like a different core deep dive of different internet platforms would actually be pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be great. There's it'd be interesting to see like where there's overlap and especially where there's not, like you said.
All right, Candy Claws, hell yeah.
All right, number three, Jay Paul. This is the what's called Leak, April 2013/Bait Ones. You know, my apologies to Jay Paul. I know this leak sort of derailed your music career. I listened to it religiously for about 6 years until we got a official release of it, or the closest thing we'll get to resembling an official release. Man, I mean, what? I mean, you know, I know he got famous off a few like MySpace singles, like BTS to You and Jasmine, but this album all the way through, it's just unbelievable. I love the wonkiness to it. There's something always off kilter about his music that I find almost reminiscent of the music of someone like J Dilla, where it's just, you know, it just sounds so natural. It sounds like his drums sound like someone actually drumming rather than a machine or something like that in his sense. Love J Paul. I actually saw that he's like performing at Coachella or something like that, so I don't know if there's any hope for new J. Paul music on the horizon, but I will be there day one.
We one day will get a really interesting oral history of that,
yeah,
because that was the era of like weird leaks that almost derailed people. Like Grizzly Bear had The Ketamist leaked early, which ended up being a good thing from them, because that's when Jay-Z and Beyonce got into them, apparently. But, you know, that was an era where we were post Radiohead and Rainbows, It's Free. But we still weren't in an era where labels or A&R or press was still really comfortable with leaks and being like, ah, screw it, people are going to like it. You know, it sucks, but people are going to like it. And it was very obvious that Jay Paul just like was a perfectionist, clearly, because he's not really made anything since, but he seemed devastated by it, which always makes me sad because it's such a good record just leaked.
But in some ways it also adds to the mystique, so it makes me like the record even more. So that's kind of the double-edged sword.
Yeah, for sure. All right, top two. I'm interested because we'll talk about the video more, but when you and Spencer were talking, there was a lot of deliberations on the top two. So I'm assuming your personal top two, there might have been some internal, you know, judgment calls going on. Gotta do the knife's edge of which one's better.
Definitely. Okay, so number two is going to be Queens of the Stone Age, Like Clockwork. Very, very popular, very well-known album. It's, you know, Songs for the Deaf, probably still their most popular and most critically acclaimed, I guess. But this album is so much better, honestly. I don't think people were necessarily prepared for a Queens of the Stone Age record that was this artsy. It's, you know, they were known, you know, as just, they're just an excellent, you know, hard rock band, you know, alternative rock band. And this, it's so artsy. I love the lyricism on this. I think I Appear Missing is one of the most beautiful songs ever made. And just, you know, the singles are great, you know, like, Sat by the Ocean, excellent. Love even the slower stuff, the piano stuff, like, you know, Vampire Time and Memory and the final track, the closing track. So, this is pretty much a perfect album all the way through. And it's really funny to compare this to what my number one will be, because my number one is not a perfect album by any means, but it just happens to be my favorite.
Like Clockwork's an interesting one. I adore it. I think it's my favorite Queens of the Stone Age outside of Rated R. And I think one of the things that is going forward is it's almost like the totality of rock, because Elton John's on it as a backup singer at one point. And you do have these like rock piano ballads that are like Warren Zevon-esque or, you know, or Elton John-esque. And you also have I Appear Missing, which is a rock epic. You have Smooth Sailing, which is this weirdo out of left field, like scuzz rock thing. And it's almost like the totality of various different rock subgenres all smashed into one album, but still having the same through line of Josh Homme's like corrosive charisma, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
That record rules. Yes. Okay, so the first one is not perfect.
It's not, I mean, not even close to perfect, but I got curious on the website because there's little write-ups on the website for like each album that's chosen to be highlighted. I was like, was this album highlighted? And it was. And I was a little bit surprised by it, but my number one's going to be Titus Andronicus, The Monitor. That is, to me, absolutely astonishing record. A loose conceptual album based on America's Civil War, made by a punk band from Jersey that worships Springsteen, but maybe also hates Springsteen. just because you have these Heartland rock elements to it. Oh my, and there's... It's so bloated. It's so loud. Patrick Stickles' voice sounds terrible on it. And I just love it to death. It's a phenomenal album all the way through. Titus Andronicus, The Monitor, my number one pick from the 2010s. And it's from 2010. So right at the start of that decade.
That record couldn't be perfect because it has to be drunk. It has to be sloppy. The theme from Cheers does not hit as hard if it's not about to fall apart at any moment.
Right.
I adore that record. I saw Pat Stickles play a solo show in a record store in Portland. He was obviously drunk. He played Crocodile Rock, lost a string, and it was the sloppiest show I've ever seen in my entire life, and it will be with me until the day I die, and I feel like that's The Monitor.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because I feel like for me their discography, I like their first album Airing of Dreams is very good, but after that it just becomes even more like progressively derailed, and that to me kind of is what makes The Monitor special, because it's where just like that craziness is just like really well executed in a way that it really hasn't been for the rest of the music they make, at least in my opinion. So I think when you have, it's just like right place, right time, you know, right place emotionally, right place musically, you know, you get a masterpiece, and that's The Monitor. I think it's a total masterpiece.
How did it hit you when it came out? Like, was there an emotional core to it? Was the sloppiness almost something that hit your heart in a certain way?
Maybe. I just hadn't heard anything like it at all. And, you know, I Hey, that's one of those. I think maybe Pitchfork gave it a good review or something like that. It was probably like me in high school, you know, reading Pitchfork regularly. And it's an album that's only grown on me more as I get older and older. Because when I was in high school, I liked it. When I was in college, I loved it. And now I'm, you know, a few years removed from that, and it's one of my all-time favorites. So I don't really, you know, I don't really know how I necessarily grew to love this album, but it's just there's just something about it, you know, it's just something kind of magnetizing, hypnotic almost.
Yeah, it's incredible. So we've brought up Rate Your Music. We've brought up Pitchfork. The specter of Anthony Fantano looms above us at all times.
Sure. I mean, especially I'm a YouTuber, so for
Yeah,
crying out
I
loud.
was about to say, even more above you. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you outside of just sharing some musical knowledge, and those are just stellar picks, man. We should have had you on when we did the end of the decade roundup, was the idea of. We are currently in a really interesting era in YouTube of sports YouTubers who are a little bit at left field. There's a lot of analytics, but there's a lot of storytelling. I'm thinking of you. I'm thinking of 5 Points. I'm thinking of obviously John Boz and Alex Rubenstein over at Secret Base, where it's this interesting combination of we will give you news and analytics, but also there's a story behind it. Baseball Bits is it has a narrative to all these stories. My personal favorite video you put out is about Yadier Molina. I think personally, because I'm an Astros fan, so I hate that man so much. But also it's a fascinating story. And I'm curious on your end why you think over the last maybe 5 or 6 years there's been an explosion in analytics plus narrative plus a little bit left of center sports YouTube.
Yeah, I so a lot of it I think revolves around the copyright policies of some of these leagues, and MLB is no exception. I've always told people, you know, the phrase, you know, without the express written consent of Major League Baseball, like kind of exists in the cultural lexicon if you've watched enough like sports broadcasts over the last you know, few decades. So I don't know officially when it happened, but there was sort of like you know, there was a time where if you put a clip from a baseball game on YouTube, it would get taken down. And that position has sort of evolved as I think MLB has realized that they need to find a way to attract younger fans to the game. And the internet is, of course, maybe the most powerful tool possible to do that. And so, you know, the point where it's reached now with the league is, you know, as long as I am very transformative with my work, not only will it stay up on YouTube, like I'm able to monetize it and collect ad revenue from it. And so when you have, you know, when you give creators, you know, basically, you know, the keys to the car, I think they're able to, you know, create different types of content that they wouldn't have been able to, you know, 5 years ago. So a big part of that, I think, is actually just comes from evolving policy towards copyright on YouTube from some of these major sports leagues as to why you're seeing some of this content pop up now when, you know, like you said, 5 years ago, there wasn't really anything like it.
Yeah, and I think you and I are about the same age. I'm also thinking about how things like ESPN and SI has changed over the years. I remember SI for Kids, and I
Oh,
remember
yeah.
ESPN Classic doing top 5 reasons you can't blame, or who's number one, and these things that were not just breaking news coverage. It was not as much as I love First Take for sheer like Twitter reaction things, you know. It was not the just immediate hot take and stuff like that. It could be a little bit more thoughtful. It could be a little bit more weird. And I think it feels like within the baseball and football realms, we have a number of YouTubers, yourself included, like with Baseball Bits. I mean, you just had a video over Fursonas. Well, yeah, more accurately, a spotting of furries and
That's right.
what that may do for baseball. Yeah, I'm wondering if that kind of left fieldness kind of left for a while in sports coverage and has been taken up. That oddball, screwball, but still very captivating thing has been taken up by YouTube.
Definitely. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. Like the Sklar brothers had that show. I think it was on ESPN 2, Cheap Seats. And I was just sort of thinking like how that is almost like a show now when you think about it. It's like, yeah, this is like a lot of what people are doing on the internet now. They were just doing it on ESPN, you know, 15 years ago. Or even like, you know, I've gotten to know, you know, Chris Rose, who now, you know, works with the John Boy guys, previously MLB Network. And I remember watching him on like Best Damn Sports Show, period, you know,
yeah.
you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so these are the types of things that, you know, you aren't likely to find on TV anymore. So people have, you know, gone to the internet to make their own versions of them. And so I think that's probably a big element of it, is that, yeah, we're introducing or we're reintroducing that out of left field, oddball, wacky element to sports coverage. But I think it was always there.
Yeah, I completely agree. And we were talking about Rate Your Music, because this is one of the interesting parallels, I think. Music and sports, obviously not a one-to-one in terms of ability to look at technical ability, look at, you know, facts within the music. One is much more objective than the other, obviously.
Right.
But Rate Your Music, as the name implies, if someone has not gone to that website, is an aggregate of various music nerds rating music on a scale of 1 to 5 and or 0.5 to 5. And on top of that, being able to use genre descriptions and tags of things happening within the album or certain emotions or even seasons that come up to people while listening to it. And it is broken down by year or can be broken down by genre. And it feels very analytical for a completely subjective art form. And at the same time, obviously, this has been going on a little bit longer. You can go back to Moneyball and the Oakland Athletics, but there also has been an explosion in analytics and sports, which has ruffled some feathers. This is the classic fight of thinking about clutch and heart and grit versus war and sabermetrics. And I'm wondering if you see any parallels between those two, especially we also mentioned Pitchfork, which rates everything on a 10.0 scale as well, trying to put the objective to the subjective.
Well, people, yeah, I think people want to, you know, in the baseball world, the question is, what can we quantify next, right? Like, so, you know, 10 years ago, one thing that wasn't really quantified, and it's all over the Yadier Molina video, is catcher framing. You know,
the
idea was that, you know, a catcher is good at, you know, receiving the ball in a way to push the call into their favor, turn a ball into a strike. And before that, you know, that you read articles from the 50s and the 60s talking about catchers, like, you know, Yogi Berra, be like, he's such a smooth receiver of the ball, you know, sometimes it even tricks the umpire, but there's no way to quantify it until fairly recently. And I think that's kind of what Rate Your Music is going through. Like, there, you have music gives you all these feelings and emotions, but how can you, you know, quantify that? And in baseball, there's certain things we are able to accept can't be quantified. And probably the biggest one would be maybe, you know, the effect of clubhouse chemistry. You know, how much better does it make a team when all the players are getting along? How much better does it make a team when the players really like their manager, for example? Those are things that can't really be quantified, those intangibles. And I think that's kind of what Rate Your Music is going to, you know, constantly be grappling with, is, you know, there are certain qualities of albums and music you can look at objectively, but so much of the experience of listening to it is subjective. You know, how can you quantify that? And should you quantify that?
Well, speaking of quantify, you had Spencer Strider on Foolish Bailey and went through the top 6 Strokes albums. I think generally correct. I would have put Is This It first, but Room on Fire is amazing. I just did Reptilia at karaoke a couple of days ago, so it's good. Spencer and his friends have one of the most bonkers charts of how to correctly identify and quantify music I think I've ever seen in my entire life. And to quote him, it would take hours to explain what the whole shebang was. But when y'all were talking, let's say before or off camera or, you know, emailing, did you get a sense of what that chart was and how it became sort of this go-to thing for him of rating all of this music and why it became important for him? Because he's obviously a massive music nerd.
Well, so I knew he liked the Strokes. There'd been a big blurb about it written in The Athletic, how he, whenever he starts, the locker room is playing the Strokes discography, basically. Like, that's his pick. And so I was like, okay. I was messaging him and I said, hey, do you want to come on and talk about the Strokes with me? And he was like, sure. And then a couple days later, I was like, what, how about we rate the Strokes discography? Are you comfortable with that? He was like, oh yeah, I already done that. I have a whole system for that. And I was like, oh. I was like, okay, that's good. And then so when he springs the spreadsheet on me, which is color coded and there's like pie charts on there for some reason, I was just absolutely dumbfounded. I was, you know, I mean, I, you know, don't get me wrong. Like I'll lurk on Rate Your Music. I'll even, you know, read the forums sometimes, but I don't track my listening habits to this degree, nor do I feel the need to assign a score to everything I listen to at all. So, but he had, and I don't even know if I should probably just tell him, hey, you should just, there's a website called Rate Your Music. Just go ahead and put that whole spreadsheet in there. It'll make your life a lot easier. But, yeah. And I think, you know, for him, he's just kind of like he's an information freak. He's just a freak for information. I think that's how you have to be if you're, you know, a pitcher in today's MLB. You know, how is my fastball spin rate, you know, the correct amount of RPMs? Is my, you know, fastball velocity, is it, am I averaging 97.2 today? Am I averaging 98.2 miles per hour today? So it's all these like very, you know, small fluctuations in the numbers can have a big impact on as far as like how your career goes and how much you help your team win and how much money you make. So I think that's kind of like where it's born out of, at least for someone with Spencer's background, is, you know, in baseball, it turns you into such a data freak. Why not apply that to your other interests in life?
Yeah, you've got to. I was just imagining the neural network combination of his charts and Rate Your Music. Of sort right. of like the singularity, but for the ultimate music snob, like just able to say, no, this is good, this is bad, like immediately.
Yes. Because
you were obviously like be able to see the chart like more in depth. But when he pulled that out and was like, yeah, we have breakdowns for all of these different things, including like emotional impact and context and nostalgia. And I was like, how are you quantifying any of that stuff? Like, that's
right.
Like, that it's like reverse witchcraft. It's like you're turning magic into numbers, and it scares me.
Yeah, and also it's not even just him. It's him and a really close friend of his. So what do you do when there's disagreements, for example?
On context. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I guess they just think they can be so objective about it that there's no need, you know? There's no need to have any sort of debate. They can look at it and say, well, I really like it, but the spreadsheet dictates we give it this score.
So there's another parallel that I was curious about, which is, again, us similar ages, similar backgrounds, both of us. You grew up in Georgia, right?
Correct.
I grew up in Texas. So, you know, all this, that, and the other. Another thing I was thinking about is the influence of, for sports and music, video games on American youth in our age category, because FIFA was an introduction to soccer for a lot of folks our age, especially in the United States. And I was also thinking of Guitar Hero and Rock Band being incredibly influential and important. That could be a breakout for a band, you know, and for you on baseball bits, you'll use like Undertale music sometimes as like interstitial stuff. Obviously you have pixel art in terms of, you know, these different characters that are popping up, the baseball players you're actually talking about. And you had a full Foolish video on Mario Baseball, Super Sluggers. I'm wondering for you, and we'll turn this into music in a little bit, of how you think video games becoming such a cultural monolith when it comes to sports has influenced sports fandom going into where we are now from, say, the early 2000s.
I think there's probably like a more heightened awareness of like who's who around the various sports leagues because of video games. That's probably the first sort of impact I see. You know, we're in the you know, at least in, as far as MLB goes, it's a regional sports network driven model, which means, you know, if you have cable, for example, you're going to watch the team that's in your market. And unless you're like, you know, you're going to subscribe to MLB TV and you're just like a hardcore baseball fan, you're not going to see the other teams that much. And especially, you know, in times, you know, where interleague play wasn't as common, or, you know, so there are times where, you know, you could be a diehard baseball fan of a team that's in the National League, like the Braves, but not really know like necessarily what's going on in the American League at any given time. And I think, you know, video games can change that up a lot, because if you're just playing as different teams and you're playing against different teams, you just get a, like a really increased awareness of like who is on every roster, how is this roster constructed, you know, who are the star players on every single team. And so I think, you know, it's just a video games, I think, first and foremost in the sports world, are a really good tool to learning the players and the who's who. And that's, I mean, FIFA was definitely that for me. I didn't know really very many soccer players at all until I started playing FIFA probably, you know, 10, 9, 8 years ago. And now it's been a few years since I played. It's been a few years since I followed the European leagues, you know, but it gave me sort of like a, at least a foundational understanding of the players on each team, and also just the, you know, the structure of the league itself, what are the rules, you know, because I mean, especially like you said yourself with soccer, right? Like it's, you know, the video game might be the best way to explain like the table and like relegation and things like that, that just wouldn't make any sense to a North American sports fan otherwise.
Yeah, I agree. And it is interesting to see that kind of as a gateway drug. Again, looking at Guitar Hero and Rock Band, it's very similar to actually what you said about focusing on these different teams. Obviously, Guitar Hero and Rock Band were both rock-oriented, but it did not have to be one subgenre of rock. There was metal, there was pop, there was some R&B influence here and there. And I remember being, you know, 12 or 13, you know, I already knew who Nirvana and Weezer were, you know, obviously, but like there was progressive rock I'd never heard of. Like, who the hell's Coheed and Cambria? You know, things like that. And that being suddenly like, oh, well, this band's interesting and they were on Rock Band, so let's take a look at this band. And I could see it being a very similar thing for fandom within sports. I was remembering, you know, the huge breakdown of the Seattle Mariners by Secret Base, where they kept talking about the Mariners as this like distant satellite object away from everybody. And I've never thought of them as that, but that's because I've always had video games. I've always been able to play as Ichiro, you know what I mean? Which is a go-to thing in any baseball game from that era, is just, can I trade Ichiro to myself or am I playing as the Mariners?
He's unreal in backyard baseball as well. I was just going to say, he's unreal in that game.
That brings up something else. I've wanted to pitch this to Kofi for years, which is, and I wanted to do it while David Brian Gilbert was still at Polygon, but of who is the greatest fictional athlete of all time, and why is it Pablo Sanchez?
Right. Yeah. I mean, so I can't speak to Pablo Sanchez's skills in some of the other sports. I went familiar with some of the other, but in backyard baseball, he's clearly the king. He's like Ohtani. Because he's a great pitcher too. People always forget that. His hitting, obviously everyone knows he swings a mean stick, but his pitching is also phenomenal.
Yeah. I feel like it's because Kofi did do, can you win everything with a team of Ichiros and a team of Ohtanis? And both of those won the World Series in their respective things. And very obviously you could win backyard World Series with Pablo Sanchez, but it's up there with like those three, Madden 05 Vic. And I'm trying to think, and I guess maybe Lamar in current Maddens, but
I haven't played them, but I imagine he's broken.
Yeah, there's just, I played more of the NCAA games, but I remember anytime you had a quarterback that could do the option, you just won essentially, because the AI wasn't built up to it, which is a different, entirely different weirdo thing. But yes, I've wanted to pitch that for years of like, it's probably Pablo, but let's look at everybody else too.
Yeah.